then. So if any of you are note takers, you can take some of my words. But also, I encourage you to note your physical response, your emotional response, the way the light is moving. Right? So, also to get a bit of a common grounding, I want to know if anyone knows the work of Dr. Philip Zimbardo. Is that name familiar to anyone? Or the Stanford Prison Experiment? Yeah. So, in 1971, Philip Zimbardo was a professor at Stanford and a social psychology professor. And he arranged with his department a prison experiment in which they took 27 grad students. They assigned half of them to be guards and half of them to be prisoners. And the experiment was scheduled for 2 weeks. And within just a few days, it turned into mayhem. Humiliating acts of the guards against the prisoners. Revolts and breakdowns by the prisoners. And even Philip Zimbardo himself, acting as the superintendent of this prison, found himself wrapped up in this situation so that he could not see the depth of the cruelty when the experiment had gone too far. It took somebody else coming into the situation and recognizing that people were becoming very damaged. And the main lesson from this that I think Zimbardo learned was the capability in each of us to be perpetrators of evil. And he spent the rest of his career studying evil, the social, individual, and systematic factors that allow us to become perpetrators of evil. He consulted on the trials at Abu Ghraib, interrogation prison in Iraq, where American soldiers humiliated the prisoners. The first images that came out of Abu Ghraib were of naked prisoners piled on top of each other, dirty, scarred, bruised, with the American soldiers in the photo with the thumbs up, smiling, grinning. And he recognized that this was very similar to the effects of the prison experiment. That people had become part of the system of authority. Right? So much ingrained that they didn't even recognize it until an outsider came in. A private was assigned to this ward, this interrogation room. And even being an outsider in the culture, even being of lower rank than all of the other people in the room, this soldier made the choice to report these acts. So, after 50, 60 years of studying evil, Dr. Philip Zimbardo said, well, not everybody does that. Some people, in the very similar situations, become heroes. That it is the same situation in which we can become a perpetrator of evil or become a hero. And that the line between good and evil is movable, is penetrable. And since Dr. Zimbardo and his faculty have created what's called the Heroic Imagination Project, and it is a training model to illuminate the factors that can go into those choices, that moment of choice, the conformity, obedience, the bystander effect, and how by training in these we can become a hero in waiting, as he calls it. And what I'd like to talk about today is how we apply that to our work in the world, bodhisattva work, it's called. The bodhisattva being a archetype of someone who has come from their own sense of the mind of enlightenment and committed to an effort to cultivate the mind of enlightenment everywhere, for everyone, for all beings. So, how might we become bodhisattvas in waiting? There's a poem there on the program, and this is a poem from Dogen. I'll just read that. Of natural wondrous wisdom, itself is true suchness. Why should we employ Confucian discourse or Buddhist texts? Rely on sitting at ease at your place and hang your mouth on the wall. Friends arrive here and are released from emptiness. The natural wondrous wisdom exists in us already. It might become shaded by a situation, getting used to a situation. When we come back to beginner's mind and face things for the first time, then that suchness can shine through. And this is not from our training of civil action, of Confucian discourse, the way that we are meant to behave, or from Buddhist texts, the way that we are meant to think. It is just in the act of sitting in our own place, sitting at ease, creating a center so we know we are acting from emptiness and shed our judgments, shed our assumptions, and act from emptiness. Meet friends. Meet joy and aversion and all of our friends from emptiness. And act from there. So this poem is was given to examination graduate Rue. So we can infer that upon graduation, Dogen is telling this student that everything you've learned, although it's supportive, isn't the suchness itself. What you know, what you have, the natural wondrous wisdom, that is where we act from. So let's think. So think about examination graduate Rue as a sixth grader in South Minneapolis. So Rue has had to take the standardized test, right? And this is a hard time for the students and a hard time for the teachers. And perhaps a teacher has reminded Rue that her worth is not based on the outcomes of that standardized test, and that the natural wondrous wisdom reaches far beyond that. That Rue knows her own center. Now, Zimbardo's work is applied, this heroic imagination project is implied to what's been called anti-bullying curriculum or conflict resolution curriculum in the schools. And so we can see here that Rue knows her center. Maybe Rue is popular and is at the top of her class when her friends begin to tease another person, this other stupid, ugly person. Can Rue stand up in that conformity at that moment of choice at great risk to her social standing? Great risk. And say, you can't bully her. She knows she's not stupid. She knows she's not ugly. So in that moment, Ru has become a hero, has become a bodhisattva. So we find another piece of this in the situational or social aspect. And in a dialogue attributed to the Buddha, there is what's called Buddha's instructions to the Kalamas. And the Kalamas are a people in a town called Kesputa. And Kesputa is kind of on the circuit, right? It's where all of the preachers are coming through, the gurus, the snake charmers, the magicians. Everyone with all these different ideas coming through. And the Kalamas say to the Buddha, whose reputation precedes him, there are so many truths. There are so many truths. How do we know which one to believe, to act on? There are so many magicians, so many ideas. Where do we fit in? Which one is right? Take a card, any card. Okay. Don't show me your card. You can look at your card. I'll close my eyes so you can show it to your friends. All right. Good. And put the card back into the deck. They say that seven times makes random, do you think? Okay, we're just going to do one because we can't be here all day. So, the Kalamas say to the don't listen to me. I only know one card trick and I messed it up. Here we go. Try again. Pick a card, any card. Okay. You can show it to people if that's helpful to us. Okay. And put the card back in the deck. For the interest of time, we won't show. No. Okay. I just want to do it right for you guys. Come on. So the Kalamas say there are so many truths. What do we do? How do we know what to do? And the Buddha responds, do not go by oral tradition, although we only have the introduction to Kalamas because of oral tradition. Do not go by lineage of the teaching. Right? There's an emphasis on lineage in this sect, in this Soto Zen Buddhism sect. And we say that Bodhidharma was the first patriarch of China, kind of the beginning of what I've heard to be identified as the lineage. And Bodhidharma was a strong practitioner, great ideas. And there came a student named Wei Ka. And Wei Ka was so determined to become a student of Bodhidharma that Wei Ka cut off his own arm. Right? And we read this as a symbol of that intense intention and commitment. But if we look archetypically also at the severing of a limb, this is the act of cutting off one's own authority, own ability to act. So in the act of cutting off his own arm, Wei Ka gave up his own authority to establish power of the institution. Right? So we join in the power, give up a little of our own authority. What am I doing? I did this, right? So really, be suspicious of me. Be suspicious of my power and why am I sitting here, and help me cultivate my authentic authority. And let's help each other do that. Let's help each other cultivate our authentic authority where we can work from center and be bodhisattvas in waiting without depending on the lineage of bodhisattvas. Do not go by hearsay. A lot of people believe a lot of different things, right? Do not go by a collection of texts. This Confucius dialogue and Buddhist texts, we heard that. By logic, some people are perpetrators of evil, some people are bodhisattvas, therefore bodhisattvas are perpetrators of evil. I'm going to get mixed up in that one. By inferential reasoning, there's a story that Suzuki Roshi tells of bringing tea to his master and a guest, and always the right door, the door on the right, the door on the right. You bring the tea to the door on the right. Some of us have experienced this in the Zen tradition. There's a right way for everything. So you bring the tea to the door on the right. But one day, Suzuki brings the tea to the door on the right. And later the master berates him. So how could you bring the tea to the door on the right? And so, okay, this is new. There's a new situation. So Suzuki can infer that he is meant to bring the tea to the door on the left. Next day, brings the tea to the door on the left and gets berated. Right? This is what's going on. And the master says, well, if the guest is on the left, bring the tea to the door on the right. And if the guest is on the right, bring the tea to the door on the left. So in this inferential reasoning process, Suzuki had looked to the rules, tried to infer what the rules are, instead of investigating the situation at that moment. Where are we? Reasoned cognition. I'm a bit addicted to that myself. I love the feeling of figuring things out. Might even pretend to my deep self, pretend to not understand something, just to have that sensation of figuring it out. Right? The acceptance of a view after pondering it, what you have already decided, what I have decided moments ago, instants ago, is no longer applicable right now, right now, right now, right now, right? By the seeming competence of a speaker. So, how do you feel about that right now? This fantastic thing happened once when I was teaching Intro to Zazen, and one of the students on the way up the stairs asked me, "What does King mean on my name tag?" And I thought for a second, I was like, what on earth does that mean? And I recognized, though, that some of these name tags, like Stephanie's name tag says Stephanie Greeter. And some of the name tags, like, indicate who's on the membership committee, right? And so, I don't even remember what I said. It might have been more important to me than to her to have this experience. But I think we did get to have a little bit of a conversation about that there are titles here. There is a definite hierarchy here. But we can see it's kind of ridiculous, right? I'm the king. So, you know, rank... age, position, title do not demand respect. Investigate yourself and investigate the true heart of people and how wonderful that connection can be. Whether they're the boss of the world, a sixth grader that you just met, right? The wise. And don't go by saying, well, of course it's right because this monk is our teacher. Right? The teachings, the text, the logic, it's all very supportive and amazing. As a support, as an inspiration, as a connection, a friend on the path of a centering within the Sangha. But we don't have to give over our authentic authority. Right? So, okay, don't go by these things, right? All of these things. But when you yourself know these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them. When you yourself know, sitting at ease on the seat, the mouth hung on the wall, no input or output. Just when you yourself know, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Do that. It's not that easy, right? But live our convictions. Do that. Okay. So pick a card. Take a card. Take a card. Take a card. Take a card. It's a paradox, right? It's already our own. How do you take a card that's already your own? Okay. Paul, will you pull up the clock? Let's just see where we are. All right. So we looked a little bit at individual and situational awareness. Individual and situational bodhisattvaism. And this, this bodhisattva, there's paintings and statues and grand, grand visions of the bodhisattva. And, I want to be Batman bodhisattva. I want to be Nobel Prize winner bodhisattva, freeing all the beings. But it's choice by choice. It's moment by moment. On the playground, in traffic. And it's not for reward. So in the... what do I have? In the... in the Stanford prison experiment, somebody came in, another professor named Christine Matlock. And so she hadn't been part of the experiment from the beginning. And when she walked in, she recognized that this world had fallen apart. And although she was new to the team and in the academia didn't match rank with Dr. Zimbardo, she demanded, she brought it to their attention. She said, this experiment must be stopped. These young people are being destroyed by this. And when she reported on it, she says, the challenge has been seen by some as a heroic action, but at the time it did not feel especially heroic. To the contrary, it was very scary and lonely experience, being the deviant, doubting my judgment of both situations and people, and maybe even my worth as a research social psychologist. She was a deviant. She made herself an outsider. The systematic pieces that Zimbardo has since looked at seem to correlate really well with this sense of the friends that arrive that we can meet with emptiness. In this circle, we might say greed, aversion, hatred. And in beginner's mind, in situational awareness, in emptiness, the moment when we can meet these. So Rue grows up, right? And Rue becomes an accountant for some big something, right? And while she's working as an accountant, she notices that her boss is moving money around, benefiting the boss's friends, the boss herself. Now, if Rue does something about this, this greed, her livelihood, her job is in danger. But if she can meet this moment in emptiness, not even relying on her past values, trying to let be some of the cost-benefit of what I will get out of this or what will happen to me if I do this. If she can meet this greed in emptiness and not be in obedience to the hierarchy, then she has the opportunity to act as a bodhisattva. In aversion, if Rue is, again, working for a business that's looking to open a new location, and amongst the ideal locations, her company notes that the very most ideal location is in a safe neighborhood. And does Ruse say, safe for whom? Who, what is it that we're averse to? Who are we afraid of? She recognizes this situational, this systematic acculturation within herself and her co-workers. How simply can she say, maybe we should meet the neighbors in this neighborhood, see how they would like having this business here. And in delusion, Rue goes camping, and Rue is not afraid of bears or avalanche. She is in tuned to her very, very, very true feeling, interconnected relationship. Yet when a group of men enter the campground, then the awareness spikes. Then the situation becomes what she thinks is familiar. Then she grasps the bear spray. So, because of the delusion that the people are different than her, that are not of her, like the bears and the avalanches and all of the wondrous pieces of nature, she's willing to inflict harm upon the other without recognizing that that is also her own suffering. So, if shedding the layers of recognizing the other and of the conformity to her social understanding, she can let this friend of delusion arise and be released in emptiness. Zimbardo refers to the automatic self that it's kind of easier just to keep going on this automatic self and you're not recognizing the changes in the situation, the big situation. And he has brought a little bit of mindfulness work into his work with what he calls the pause button, right? So recognizing this experience of being on the edge of choice, that moment of choice, when we can become a bodhisattva or we can become a perpetrator of evil, pause. We're taught here to learn that spaciousness between our thoughts, even just a little bit between each thought. And in that moment of emptiness, ease up on the automatic self. Look at the situation with beginner's mind. Let's go back to this poem, given to examination graduate Rue. The obedience to authority, to Confucian dialogue and Buddhist texts. The conformity of speaking what we've taken into our mouth, out of our mouth, into our mouth, out of our mouth. Being a bystander and not recognizing the natural, wondrous wisdom that's available in each moment when we pause that automatic functioning. Natural, wondrous wisdom itself is true suchness. Why should we employ Confucian discourse or Buddhist texts? Rely on sitting at ease at your place and hang your mouth on the wall. Friends arrive here and are released from emptiness. Thank you for looking at these things with me. Let's hear a little bit of each other's experience of these words of sitting together in this room. Any questions? Yes.
I have four grandchildren, Holly, Ian, Quinn, and Ava. Holly and Ian are adults, basically. Quinn and Ava are very young and vulnerable. Holly and Ian look a lot like me. Quinn and Ava, I don't know how they will self-identify. Maybe as biracial, maybe as African-American, maybe as people of color. I love all my grandchildren. Quinn and Ava especially keep me grounded. And one of the things they've taught me is to look at my conditioned self. And I've been fortunate in making choices about reading different books, Frederick Douglass's amazing autobiography, or W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk. I think as a white person, I need to engage in Confucian discourse in order to look at my conditioned self and understand more about all the things I carry along with me. Yesterday, there was a rally and demonstration. It was a Million Artists Minnesota, and it was part of a nationwide protest against police brutality, against inequality and injustice. And maybe some of you were there. I don't know what it was. It was a very encouraging experience. There were people there of all ages and all colors. We marched at one point and actually laid down at the intersection of 7th and Hennepin. There were many excellent speakers there, and there was also a woman who was a singer, and she taught us a song, and the chorus goes, I'm not going to sing it, I'll just say it if I can. One of these days I ain't going to march no more. One of these days, I ain't gonna march no more. But while my sister ain't free, and my brother can't breathe. Hand in hand with my family, we're going to fill these streets.
Thank you. I hear this willingness to, yes, enter into the Confucian dialogue, and yes, and you consider beyond that moment the ethics, making an effort to look at our systematic acculturation and to know how that influences our automatic self in discourse, in action, making an intentional effort to learn about a system, about a situation that we might not even recognize if we are in the midst of it. Yes.
I saw a documentary about that mock jail stint, and they got those guys together 20 or 25 years later.
Yeah.
And the prisoners still had very hard feelings about the way they had been treated. And one of the meanest guards was still justifying his behavior. Mm-hmm. And I was just performing the experiment and doing what they basically told me I could do. Another famous study for fame time with the Milgram.
Yeah.
The teacher and learner. So if you were the allegedly randomly assigned teacher, which you, it wasn't random at all, it was all rigged. But so let's say I was the subject, I was given permission to shock you with electricity if you answered wrong. And there was a guy down in a white coat that continued to administer the shock. And they found that 60% of the people were willing to take it right up into shocks that for all they knew were lethal, because they could not see the guy, but they could hear him saying, I have a heart condition, please stop. And the experiment would say, no, he must continue. So just today I was reading that they were kind of looking at that again, and they're saying, we all have a certain amount of integrity. So, and they were causing deep conflict in these people who were obeying authority on the one hand and wanted to stop on the other. And they even had a condition where as you walked in, the other experimenters were walking out, and one guy was saying, I'm not doing that. So they gave you a motto, but still. But the idea was that we all have a certain amount of integrity, but it's easy to overwhelm it.
Yeah.
And if they had told these guys, like, well, there's a button you can push at any moment, we'll just stop the experiment, then they might have done that. But that all of them were initially reluctant to go on, but easily, kind of manipulated into doing it. But I like the notion that in what I was reading today, saying, no, we do have integrity. It's just easily overwhelmed.
Mm.
I think there's ways, in a sense, to practice and rehearse situations where that's going to be challenged. So it's more sturdy and more natural.
Yeah.
That just reminds me of the spiritual practice.
These last two comments make me think, this of the prisoner, you know, that's what is happening with inequality in our society right now. You know, it is the condition response, right? And we do have to step out. We have to be the doctor who walked into the experiment and said, you know, wait, this is wrong. You know, it's kind of interesting.
I have to admit something to you guys. Not very many of you here were here for Ohatsu, but so last week we had a traditional retreat with like high formality, and I'm the Eno now, so it's my role to like keep things in order. Right? And I was thinking a lot about this Milgram experiment, right? In this hierarchy, I'm not overstating anything, but so you know, if I come into the group of practitioners and I say, Tim said we're going to do this, then I'm acting as the teacher in that experiment. The expert says, give more volts. And I say, you know, where do I stop if I've already started? And Philip Zimbardo referred to that experiment. So this voltage meter like went from 15 to 450. And Philip Zimbardo said that all evil starts with 15 volts. Once you do it a little bit, then you know you can.
That's why I like the Hippocratic Oath, which is also kind of a Buddhist thing, too. I mean, do no harm, right?
Right.
I mean, that would be enough. Like, if we had that, do no harm, you know? I mean, if that was there, also there.
Yeah, it's a lot of conditioning that... There's a lot of systematic conditioning between an officer of the peace and an actor of deadly force.
I have struggled in my life to find that moment. That moment, because I can never find that moment. And I did have a time quite a while ago where the moment was given to me, and so I had been carrying around so much anger that I felt in every moment anybody's response to me, I needed to somehow counter or defend, and I could never stop myself. You know, I could never find that moment. I would always be. And so I was riding my bike, and somebody came up next to me and honked their horn. And it really ticked me off, because I felt like I was riding my bike, and so what were they honking their horn? And so I actually meant to extend my middle finger, but I didn't. And it was not through my... I had been begging the universe to help me with this. And so I actually meant to extend my middle finger, but I didn't. I actually raised my hand, kind of in a greeting gesture, and it was the most enlightening thing, you know. Like, I could never find that moment in myself. I only knew how to respond, but I had been wanting that moment, and I felt like that was a gift, you know, of that moment, to respond differently. And it was pretty magical.
Yeah. Let's see, maybe one more comment or question. Yeah, Jillian.
I work in a public library, and I've been really struggling with what's going on with you and the community theory of freedom and any kind of feeling fearful and angry. But there's a security officer in the library. He came in and he was just going around talking to everybody, just saying, hey, how are you doing? How's your day? And he had these full-on conversations with the person, some of them from all walks of life. And he wasn't monitoring anyone or suspicious. He was just checking in. And it was so beautiful, and I thought and I prayed that, you know, everyone that had that situation to just have that frame of mind. Where it's peacekeeping, you know. How can I teach you to go through all these people I've been there? And even seeing the people in my perpetrators or accidents about to happen. So I want to throw you this thing, but it was a beautiful lesson for me too. It was a really nice way to unpack all of the examples about people in the world.
There's, I hear something in what you're saying also about relationship building and, you know, primarily getting to know an actual individual instead of just like assumptions, but also in that continued relationship building to perhaps be able to be helpful to someone that you didn't even expect to, like, you know, if something does happen, you're there, and you kind of know what's going on already without having to make just assumptions based on your prior view of the situation.
When I say something,
people
are like, what? What are you talking about?
That's right. That's right. Thank you. I have that trap too. I want to be a good person. Okay. Thank you all very much. Oh, Stephanie, yeah.
I'd like to let this chat without thanking you for picking a difficult topic and thus helping us experience what it is, you know, that huge gap between being an I person and a we person. And how you just can't be one or the other, but you always have opportunities to develop into a direction of, I don't know, we person isn't quite the term, but that's okay, maybe, you know, gets better with the trans people person or something like that. But to move into that direction, and maybe from other speakers who reminded us, if we can, we just don't have it enough in that moment, but then we might in the next.
Mm-hmm. In the process of reflection, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.